wives and husbands, let's turn to one of the, well, I guess I'll leave the judgment to you guys. One of the couples in Tanakh, I want to speak about the marriage of David and Michal. Michal, the daughter of Shaul. So let's turn to the text, if you will, to page... Let's go from... Turn to page 690.
Just to be clear, that's his first wife, correct?
David's first wife.
Yes.
Yes, first of several.
Yes.
Yes, we'll talk about
it. All of which he had at the same time.
Well, we will talk about that. I think it does play a role in how we interpret the story. So let's start with the story. If you remember, the last week we spoke briefly about, kind of the preamble to the story of David and Goliath. The famous story, David beats Goliath. And if you remember, before that famous battle, David HaMelech is going around speaking to people, and he's asking them, like, what's happening? He hears this giant who's making these announcements about, you know, what's going to happen and who's going to fight me. And David is asking people, like, what's happening? And they tell him the news that any person who is willing to step forward, you know, any idiot who is willing to, you know, put their life in their hands and risk fighting this giant, so what will the reward for them be? Anybody remember? They will be able to marry the king's daughter. Yes. They're allowed to be married the king's daughter. So, indeed, we find out the continuation of that story continues the next chapter after David indeed defeats Goliath, right? That's a famous story. We're going to skip it because I think you guys all know it. So, as we're told later on, we're told that David becomes very famous. He becomes this very famous war hero. Everyone knows, everyone loves him. And Shaul, who already was not a particularly happy person at this point in the narrative, becomes jealous, even more jealous, and he wants to have David killed. And so, at some point, we're told, this is at bottom page 690, we're told as follows. This is verse 14 in chapter 18. Chapter 18, verse 14, very bottom of 690. Vayhi David lechol derachav maskil v'ashem imo. God was with David, he is successful in all he does. Vayar Shaul asher hu maskil me'od, vayagor mipanav. Shaul is angry and upset with that David is so successful. V'chol Yisrael v'yuda ohevet David, ki hu yotzei v'va lifnehem. And all of Israel and Judah loves David because he fights battles for them. So now what happens? Vayomer Shaul al David. At this point, Shaul turns to David and says, Hine vitiha gedola, meirav ota etim lecha leisha, acha yeli leven chayel vilachem milchamot Hashem. I am going to give you my daughter as a wife. Which daughter?
Meirav.
I'm going to give you Meirav, my oldest daughter, as a wife. And we're told what is his the real motives for Shaul in this story. V'Shaul amar al tihi yadibo, utihi bo yad plishtim. The real motive for Shaul is that he actually wants David dead. He wants to convince David to fight more battles. And by falsely promising him his daughter, David is going to fight these battles, and hopefully he will die in battle. And that's his hope for David. David's first response is, how can I do this? We're told right away, Vayomer David al Shaul, Mi anochi umi chayai mishpacha David b'Yisrael, Hiye chatan lamelech. Who am I? You know, I'm not that important. How is my family that important? How can I possibly be the king's son-in-law? Right? That seems to be such a, such a promise that I can't really hold up to. And we're told, interestingly enough, Vayhi be'et teit et mirav bat Shaul David, at this time, though she was promised for David, who does Meirav end up marrying? Someone else. She ends up marrying someone else, which is seems like a betrayal. They went back on their deal. What are we told? Continuing. V'tehav Michal bat Shaul et David. At the same time, right, this is almost like a classic, almost like a sitcom, right? The younger sister, she falls in love with David, right? You can almost imagine it. The young, handsome guy comes to the house, supposed to get married or engaged with the older daughter. And who's really jealously waiting? The younger sister. She falls in love with the handsome guy, you know, at the table, she wants to marry him. So Michal falls in love. Vayagidu Shaul Vayishar Davar Beinav. So Shaul hears this news and he likes it. Why? Because again, the same reason. Excuse me. Vayomar Shaul Itnana Lo Vetuhilo Mokesh Utivo Yad Plishtim. For the same reason, I'm going to give you my daughter with the real motive that you will die in battle again, fighting for my daughter. So the same thing happens. I'm going to skip a few verses. We have a lot of verses.
No excuse as to why he didn't give him.
No, no explanation is given. Nothing is, no explanation is given about the first daughter.
And David doesn't complain.
David does not complain. David's response is, I'm not worthy.
No, he's not worthy. Right?
He's not worthy. A little bit later on, he's told this news, and that's verse 23. Take a look at David's response. Vaydabru avde shobe uznei David et avrei ma'ila. David has relayed the news that, you know, Shaul wants him as a son-in-law. Vayomer David, hanakala ve'inichem hitratein ba'melech, ve'anochi ish rash v'nikleh. David says, how can I possibly do this? I am a poor man. I'll mention as an aside. I'll mention a little bit later. I'll come back to this. Vayagidu avdei Shaul lemor kadvarim eileh diber David. So Shaul has relayed that information. Vayomer Shaul ko tamru leDavid. So Shaul's response, right, you are poor. It's true, but ein chafetz lamelech b'mohar. I'm not looking for a large dowry, right? You don't need to give me, you know, $100,000 to marry my daughter or whatever the, you know, equivalent is, right? Instead, what do I want from you? Ki bimeya or lot plishtim lihinakim ve'oyve ha-melech. What I really want from you is I want you to defeat the plishtim. I want you to bring me 100, literally foreskins from the plishtim. I want you to defeat my enemies, 100, you know, give me 100 heads on a spike. That's what I really want. Shaul Chashav, and again, we're told again, the whole motivation here for Shaul is he wants David to be die in battle. So David likes his plan. David likes his plan. Litratein b'melech, to marry the king's family. Velo malu hayamim, and the days did not, there were not many days until indeed this transpired. Vayakum David, David and Eve goes up to battle. Vayelechu v'anashav, vayach beplishtim, matayimish. And he defeats not 100 plishtim, but 200 plishtim. He defeats. Vayavei David orlotehem, vaymal'u lamelech, vaytratein bamelech, vaytenlo Shaul et michal bito leisha. And so we're told, indeed, he presents, you know, Shaul's plan is ruined. Indeed, David is victorious in battle. He actually doubles the initial offer. He brings 200, you know, heads on a spike, and indeed they get married. Shaul marries off his daughter to David. And the story kind of concludes here, like the small conclusion. Vayar Shaul vayeda ki Hashem im David u'michal bat Shaul ahavato. And so we're told here that Shaul sees and is upset the fact that David, that Kadosh Baruch Hu is protecting David, and Michal loves David. Any questions or comments so far from the story? Okay, I'll make like a small aside. I want to keep reading because there's a lot to talk about in this story. We're gonna focus more on the story a little bit later. I will make an aside that there's something really interesting about this story that might remind you, we're not going to talk about it too much, but might remind you a little bit of the story later on in Shmuel Bet, where someone else decides to try killing, someone else wants to get married, or there's a marriage proposal on the table of some sort, and someone else is sent to the front lines to battle, ostensibly for the real purpose of being killed, so that someone else can have them for a wife. And there is the same discussion about a poor man. Yes, David and Bathsheba. David and Bathsheba. Where there, he sees a pretty woman, like bathing or something, you know, on the roof, famously painted in, you know, by many famous artists. And he wants to marry Bathsheba. What does he do? He sends Uriah, her husband, off to battle, right? For the real reason of he wants to kill him, have him killed. So he's sent off to the vanguard where he's, you know, where usually, I guess that's like the most dangerous position in the battle. He indeed does die so that he can marry. And afterwards, Natan HaNavi, the prophet, comes over to David and says to him, I want to give you Musar, I'm going to give you critique, and how am I going to do so? I'm going to give you a parable. What's the parable? The parable is about a man who was poor and loved his single sheep, Kivshah HaRash, the poor man and the sheep. And what ends up happening in the parable is that a rich man comes and takes the sheep from him. Even though he loves the sheep and he doesn't have any other sheep, rich man comes and takes the sheep, meaning a clear parable to David, who has many wives and is taking the one wife of this guy, Uriah. But all of that kind of harpens back in this story, where we have this concept of a battle here. David, in this case, is the poor man. And it kind of, I think, certainly part of that narrative is certainly playing up here. It kind of, the tables have turned, and David now kind of becomes the role of his future father-in-law, Shaul. So it's certainly part of the critique of David later on. That's kind of all of an aside. It's not really so much the focus of this story, but I think it reframes a little bit what David's actions in the future are, certainly based on this narrative here. Any questions or comments about that? Great. So I want to move on, and I want to talk about the next part of the story before we start analyzing and come back to this part. So the next part of the story, we're going to skip a bit, because the next page, as the narrative develops, we're told more and more that Shaul begins to not just hate David, but really wants to get rid of him. Right now, it's not just conspiring to do so by like bringing him to battle. He actually explicitly tries killing him in many overt ways. And so David gets saved by his son Yonatan, by David's friend Shaul's son Yonatan. And at some point, we're told as follows. Turn to page 694. Shaul wants to kill him at home. And so we're told the following interesting story. Verse 11, page 694, verse 11. Vayishlach Shaul malachim el beit David l'shomro l'hamito baboker. Shaul sends messengers to the house of David to stand guard overnight and capture him in the morning. Right? You're not going to capture him, I guess, in the middle of the night. But for whatever reason, but they're going to stand guard at the door, and in the morning they're going to come and take him and kill him. Vatagezu David Michal ishto limor. So who comes to David's rescue? His loving wife, Michal. Michal comes to him and says, "Im eincha mimaleit nafshecha halayla machar ata mumat. If you don't run away tonight, you will die." So what does she do? Vatored Michal David be'ada chalon vayelech vayivrach vayimaleit. So what does she do? She descends David down a window, and that way he's able to escape. Vatikach Michal es ha-trafim. So what does Michal do? She then takes the trafim, the, how are you translating here? The mannequins? Okay. I'll leave it at that for now. It takes the mannequins, I guess, which whatever they had back then. Not sure why they would have mannequins. I'm not sure it's an accurate translation, but okay, we'll take mannequins. Vatasim el amita ve'et kvir ha'izim sama mirashotav vatechas ba'baged. So what does she do? She does like, any person wants to hide someone pretending to be in bed. You stuff the pillows, put the covers, make it look like someone's in bed hiding when they're really not. So meanwhile, this all happens at night. The next morning, the messengers come into the house. They want to go and grab David. And what does she say? Vatomer cholehu. She says, don't come any closer. He is sick. Maybe he's contagious even. He can't leave the bed. Vayishlach Shaul et ha-malachim lirot David lemor, halu oto v'amita elai l'hamito. Shaul, all this like kind of, giving David more time to run away. In the meantime, Shaul is told this news, he's sick. Shaul says, I could care less that he's sick. Bring him to me, he's going to die anyways. He's sick, what's make a difference? So bring him to me. Vayavo ha-malachim v'hineh trafim el hamita. Oh, they find out, indeed, David is not there. Where did he go? And they discover the trick. At that moment, Shaul has his daughter Michal brought to the palace. Right, he's upset. He finds out that there was a whole trick. They tricked him. Vayomer Shaul al Michal. So Shaul says to Michal, "Lama kacha rimitani? Why did you trick me like this?" But tashalchit oy vivai malit. You have sent away my enemy. Right, you have let my enemy go. Vatomer Michal al Shaul, who amar elai shalachani v'lama amitech. She says to Shaul, he told me, let me go or else you will die. Right? So she lied. Right? She's trying to cover her own skin, effectively saying that, but she lies. And we're told, indeed, David runs away. And the story continues, David runs away. He ends up keeping run away for many years after this. That's kind of the story. We're going to come, there's more to the Michal story, but I want to stop at this point right here. How do we feel about Michal and David's relationship?
It's like it's one-sided, actually, that she loves him.
It's really interesting.
Nothing about him loving
him. Yes, very true. Yeah. She loves him, and we're told several times. In fact, quick trivia question, she's the only person in Tanakh, only woman, to describe that she loves a man.
Right.
There are several men who love women, but this is the only woman who loves a man. Not that I don't think there's any other love stories, but, you know, women are not usually the main character. But here, Michal loves David. Mm-hmm. And it's worth noting, are we ever told that David loves Michal?
No.
No, never. Not once. Not a single time is it mentioned that he loves Michal.
We know he loves Bathsheba.
Not clear he loves Bathsheba. I'm not sure if it says that he loves Bathsheba.
He lusted after.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I have to look it up. I'm not sure if he uses the word, like, ehav when it comes to Bathsheba.
Okay.
I have to look it up, but I'm not sure about it. But certainly when it comes to Michal, it seems to be one-sided. And what does Michal do? She goes out of her way to save him. Right,
against her father,
and goes against her father, right? This is who wants to kill him. He's not just a father; he's also the king, right? This pretty impressive story. Mm-hmm. There is a remarkable parallel that this story presents with another story in Tanakh. Another story. Anybody have any guesses right away? What I'm thinking about? I'll give you some more hints.
Shimshon.
Well, there is running away there too. Yeah, there's some similarities.
In Chumash or in
no? In Chumash.
So Rivka and when she sends Yaakov away.
Yeah, there's similar things about running away, but there's something even closer to that.
Let me give you
a few examples.
Yeah,
It's a story of a person. Who wants to marry into a family. And this individual, the person he goes up to marry, has two daughters.
Right.
Yeah.
And
Rachel.
Yes, Leah and Rachel. Oh. And this person, just like Shaul, who has two daughters, he ends up, what does he do? He works in order to marry the daughters. Mm-hmm. Just like David works by killing, you know, Plishtim, Yaakov works for 7 years and then another 7 years in order to marry Rachel. Mm-hmm. In both stories, initially, they're supposed to marry one woman. Mm-hmm. And what ends up happening? Some type of trickery, not entirely clear what happens in this story. And they end up marrying, well, at least someone else, right? In this story, it's someone else entirely. And in the story there, he marries both of them. But there's some trickery about who he ends up marrying. Mm-hmm. What else? Anything else?
Yeah, Rachel says that she's sick, right? That she can't get all
the animal. Yes, in both stories. Let's come back. I'm going to come back to that one. I'm going to come back to that in a second. Before we get to the running away part, get to that. In both stories, in terms of the marriage proposal, before we get to the, like, when they're already married, but the marriage proposal, both times, how much were they initially, what was the deal? How long were they have to work for?
7 years.
7 years. Mm-hmm. And how long did Yaakov end up working for?
14.
And in this case, what was David supposed to do? He was supposed to kill 100. And how many does he end up killing?
200.
So there's like a doubling,
oh.
Right? Voluntary, sure, but, you know, there's a small difference. I don't mean to, deny the differences, but it's interesting if there's one more parallel in that.
Mm-hmm.
And in both cases, I mean, this is something people point out. I don't think it's the strongest parallel, but it's worth noting that Rachel's child is Binyamin, and Michal is a Benjamite, because her father, Shaul, is from Binyamin. Right? So we already have similar families even involved here. The word usage here is also similar because you also have similar words about ki mal'u yamai, that the days have come. We have similar languages about both stories that it didn't take long for it to happen. With Yaakov, it's almost like a ironic usage. It didn't take very long until he got married because for him it was very quick, even though we know it was 7 years. So there's a clear irony there. It really was a long time. But in this story, apparently they get married quickly and the same words are used. So we have a lot of similarities in this part of the story. In the next part of the story, they get married. And what ends up happening? Does Yaakov stay with Laban forever?
No.
What does he do? He not just leave. He runs away. Oh. Right? They run away, and not the dead of night, but they run away. Laban is on a 3-day journey. Is away. Yaakov is told Laban is not here. And what does Yaakov do? He calls together his two wives, Leah and Rachel, and he says to them, I had a dream about God appearing to me. Go back to your land. And I want to know, do you want to come with me? Do you agree? And what do the daughters say? Let's go. Our father never loved us to begin with. Let's go. We want to leave with you. So they leave with him. And they run away. In fact, the whole story is clearly about running away, because then Laban comes and chases after him.
Why'd you run away?
Why'd you run away? The whole story is about running away. And in this story, what is David doing? He's running away, right? Because Laban wants to kill him. And in both... Shaul wants to kill him, yes. Shaul wants to kill him. And in both stories, the wives play a rather important role. In the story with here, right, Michal plays an indispensable role. She literally brings him down the window. And what does Rachel do? Well, Rachel hides Trofim. Right, it's not as important to running away, but she certainly encourages him in running away. And then she hides these Trofim, these, call them idols of some sort, some fertility idol, that's probably what it was. That's the way most people assume some type of fertility idol. She hides these Trofim underneath her. Right? And what does she tell her father? I can't get up because derech nashimli. Because I have probably most literal translation, I'm menstruating. I have menstruating pains right now.
Not
clear. She might have been pregnant.
Because I don't think it took 9 months to get the...
Yeah, maybe she didn't know she was pregnant. No. Yeah. Either way, she was in some type of pains. That's what she says. Some womanly pains, you know.
Doesn't matter. She's lying. I mean, she's faking it anyway.
Yeah, she's lying about it. I mean,
pregnant.
Yeah, she's definitely lying. I mean, like, maybe she was in pain, but it definitely, the story implies that she could have gotten up, but she intentionally is lying. And here, we have the same thing. Michal is approached by her father, or called into her father, and she lies.
Sorry, who lied?
Leah? Sorry, Rachel lied. Rachel lies because she stole the Trofim for herself.
But we don't know.
Or she stole them in general.
Yeah, okay.
And in that story, she lies to her father about why she can't get up.
Okay.
In this story, Shaul calls his daughter, and she lies to protect her husband.
Mm-hmm.
And in both stories, as was pointed out, we have the same reference to Trofim, to this fertility idol, something. Not entirely clear what they are. We can talk about it, you know, at different time. But there is the same type of... It's translated here as... what was it translated as?
Mannequins.
Yeah, I don't think that's a really accurate translation. Mm-hmm. It fits better within context in terms of, like, part of the hiding. But I actually think Trofim probably has to do with... Typically in Tanakh, Trofim are these type of fertility idol drugs, some sort of fertility-related... product of some sort. And in both cases, not only is it true that the daughters lie, but the lying has to do with the same type of thing. In both cases, the woman says, I or my husband can't get up because I/he is sick, right? Either because I have female pains, right? This is like a very clean way of saying it, that's like the, or because he's actually, because David is pretending to be sick, right, that he's hiding in bed. So we have this very, very similar story here. Almost, it's almost impossible to, like, not see these two stories in conversation. And in both cases, the father-in-law finds out that he was tricked. And in both cases, the father-in-law comes over and says, Lama rimitani, why did you trick me? Right, they use the exact same language. Why have you tricked me? Yaakov is told, accused by Laban, why did you trick me? And here, Shaul says to his daughter, why did you trick me? I'll keep mentioning other parallels, not in this story, but at some point later on in the story, we're told that the father-in-laws end up at some point meeting their son-in-law, and they have some sort of reconciliation of sorts. And in this reconciliation, they say the same line of, our gods should judge us. By Yaakov and Laban, they make a treaty, and they say, Elohei Avraham ve'Elohei Nachor, ishpatu v'neinu, the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor. They should judge between us whether either one of us will break our deal with each other. And the story of David and Shaul is a bit later on in the story, but at some point they end up meeting together, and they call to each other and say, V'haya Hashem ledin v'shofet b'ni uv'necha. They call God as a witness, as a judge between the two of them. It's almost the exact same line, right? We have very similar stories here. Father-in-law, son-in-law, two wives, right? Almost very similar stories. The wives end up getting enmeshed and trying saving them. These very, very similar, you know, stories happening in both cases. Any questions or comments about it? Why the parallel? What are they suggesting?
My question. So what's the point?
What's the point? Okay, great. So what? Any suggestions? What do you guys think?
I mean, the father-in-law reaction is valid, right? Why did you trick me? It's a valid question. It's like, don't you have any loyalty to me? So obviously the daughters have loyalty to the husbands first.
Right.
But
so I want to suggest perhaps two ways of looking at it. One way of looking at it is perhaps to compare the two stories in terms of, you know, who's in the right here. Right? In the story of Yaakov and Rachel, right? Yaakov loves Rachel. Were we told anything about how Rachel feels about Yaakov? No, we're not. We're not really told, like, how she feels about him. And they end up running away together. Like, the whole family runs away. And she steals the trophim. Now, did she steal the trophim for Yaakov?
No.
No.
For herself.
She steals it for herself, maybe against her father. It's not entirely clear. We can talk about the debate, but it's certainly not for Yaakov. Mm-hmm. That for sure is true. And Yaakov is then accused by Laban of stealing something. Mm-hmm. And what does Yaakov say? He says,
whoever did it should drop down.
Whoever should do it will die. Yeah. Whoever you find these trophim will die. And indeed, famously, Rachel stole the trophim, and Midrash famously says that's why she ends up dying later on in childbirth. Right? So we have this type of disconnect between the two of them. In this story, right, true that Michal, there's a one-way love here, but Michal does everything she can to protect David. And does she need to lie and protect David? Like, this whole story, is it necessary? Well, is it necessary for her to, you know, bring David down, run away in the middle of the night?
Yes.
That's very much necessary.
Yeah.
Right, as opposed to Yaakov, you know, certainly we understand why he wanted to leave. But he didn't necessarily need to run away middle of when his father-in-law wasn't there. He could have, you know, been more open and confronted his father-in-law openly. Mm-hmm. Instead, he, you know, decides to run and hide, right? Because that's what Yaakov does. He runs and hides. Right? Understandable, but it's less, not as justifiable as someone who's run away for their life because they're about to be killed, you know, unjustifiably. So what Michal does for her husband is, you know, this great act of, you know, marital kindness, right? She's almost sacrificing herself for her husband, right? So you can really see there's a huge disparity in the way that the two stories kind of take place. Not only that, but Yaakov ends up only being protected because God comes over to Laban the night before and says to him in a dream, do not hurt my servant Yaakov. Implying that, you know, if God hadn't been so direct, maybe Yaakov, something could have happened to him. Right? He needs God's assistance. In our story here with Michal and David, we don't get the same sense about God needing to be involved in the same way. Of course, you know, God's always behind the scenes. But you don't need the same active involvement to save the character, because Michal does so much. So I think one way certainly to read this whole story is to look at this story kind of as a positive tribute to Michal, to what she's doing for her husband, right? In contrast to Rachel, I think there's a lot of positives here in this story for Michal. But the story continues, and this is where I think...
I don't know where... Why it just popped into my head. Doesn't it say the wife should follow the husband, not, you know, when she leaves the house or, you know, when she gets married? Isn't there something that it's the duty of the wife to follow her husband? So if there's, you know,
it certainly was like a.
If there's conflict between the two, I'm not saying in these stories, but in. just conceptually, I think I've read somewhere. I don't remember.
Yeah, so I don't know if anywhere in Tanakh where it says explicitly that there's like a prescribed duty to do so, but certainly was the norms. Certainly the norms were, and I think that was the assumed duty. Yeah. I don't think it was just the norms. I think it was the assumed duty. Sorry?
Where your husband goes, you go, something.
Yeah, but there's no mention that she has to follow him. She's the curse is that that you will that at the Shugat Tov Huim Sholbach, that you will cleave after your husband, or you'll desire your husband, and he will dominate you. That's the curse. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mention anything though about following necessarily.
More about how the husband wants to move here.
Yeah, no, there are certainly. I think the legal. I think you're right that there's no explicit verses about it, but because I mean, there's no explicit verses, but I think certainly it was the norm, and that was kind of the assumption that indeed, you know, wives follow their husbands, which was, you know, the norm for
those,
you know,
days.
Well, it's still. I mean, it's still kind of true now, but certainly was true for the last, you know, thousands of years until maybe the 20th century.
As you said, though, Rachel and Leah wanted to go anyway.
Yeah, well, they wanted to go, but. Certainly, that is a story. But I think it does play a role in this story as well. Because Michal stays back in this story, right? Michal does not... well, obviously, she technically needs to stay back in order to help with the ploy, right? Because she needs to sell the fact that he's sleeping in bed. If she had run away with him, well, A, in terms of how to get down the window, someone might needed to stay up. But also, you know, wouldn't have been able to sell the same lie. So she certainly needs to stay with him. Yeah, she certainly delayed them. Yeah, 100%, she needed to stay. But David ends up running away for quite a while. Right? Exactly how long, it's really not clear, but it's at least a number of months. And does Michal ever join him? No. Where does Michal stay? What happens to Michal?
She gets remarried.
She gets remarried, yes.
Oh.
Fascinating. Take a look at page... Da, da, da. This is in chapter...
Does she know where he is, that she's left him?
Everyone else seems to know where he is. I mean, Shaul, her husband seems to certainly know around where she is.
If he really cared about her, he would have tried to get a note to her and tell her whether to meet him somewhere.
Yeah. Take a look at the very end of chapter 25. This is on page 712. Page 712. It's the very last verse in chapter 25. We're told that what happens to Michal, verse 44, Vishaul natan et Michal bito eshet David lefalti ben Laish asher migalim. Shaul gives his daughter Michal, the wife of David, to Palti ben Laish. He marries her off to someone else.
But that's right before. So right before that, right?
Right before that, yes, it is worse. I skipped these intentionally. Take a look now that you pointed it out.
Yeah.
Right before this, the story we have the story of David and Abigail. He's enamored with this woman who saves him in the whole story, and he ends up marrying her. And at the very end of verse 42 and beginning of verse 43, we're told that she marries him, but he lo leisha. And David as well marries Achinoam lakach David Mizrael, but yenegam shtehem lo lenashim. And right afterwards, we're told, oh, Shaul marries off his daughter.
How can you do that when she hadn't been divorced from David?
So it's a whole question. Shaul.
Just a minute, they had polygamy.
Well, the women could not have more than one.
He was allowed to marry his
like never, ever. But it says in the English translation, interestingly, they say David's intended wife. In other words, they make it sound like they were never married, but it doesn't make sense if they're living together.
Yeah. Yeah, it
doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, one of the big questions certainly is how Shaul will do so, like legally. Part of the question is they kind of annulled the marriage. There's like different suggestions, or maybe Shaul did the wrong thing and he forced his daughter. There are different ways of suggesting it.
This was after the Torah. So after the Torah, they didn't have annulling of marriage.
Yeah, it's certainly wrong. I think there's certainly something wrong here. Whether it's legally, whether it's legally strictly, you know, defensible, which maybe you could make some type of defensible argument. Certainly, morally, this is very much reprehensible.
She's going back to him later anyway, right?
She does, but not. Let's get to there. But I want to point out, David in this story, right? So Michal does not join David, right? There's something to be said about that, right? She gets sent off. Maybe is she willing to be sent off? We don't know. Mm-hmm. What are we told Michal's reaction to this whole other marriage? We're actually not told anything. Not so surprisingly, but you know, women often don't have voices here, but mm-hmm. we're not told about her reaction. Mm-hmm. Was she a willing participant? Mm-hmm. I don't know if she was unwilling. I mean, her father certainly forced her, but it is worth noting that the woman who loves David, you know, to death, willing to literally save his skin, is willing here to get married to someone else. And, I mean, I don't know if she's willing, but she reluctantly, or she at the very least, she does end up doing it. And not only does she end up marrying someone else, but she never joins David while he's running away, right? Mm-hmm. Any of the month, any of the time. Instead, she ends up staying effectively with
her dad,
her father. Mm-hmm. She picks a side, right? In the fight between Shaul and David, what side does she end up picking at that point?
Shaul.
Mm-hmm. Now, it is worth pointing out, I want to come back to this part of the story, but if you remember, before we talk about Michal and Michal's role here, it is worth noting, as was pointed out, their relationship here did not begin, you know, on equal footing. Right? Michal very clearly loves David. She does whatever she can for David. And what does David do for her?
Spurns her.
Does nothing.
Wait, what did you say?
Spurns
her. I mean, I don't know if he spurns her, but he certainly doesn't. He certainly isn't doing much for her. There certainly is no
trying to contact her. Right?
Yeah, there's no mention of his affection for her. And not only that, but take a look again. Let's go back to the verse earlier.
How beautiful she was. We don't even know how beautiful. They usually describe women. She was beautiful. She was this. She was that.
Yes, we don't mention that. No.
Not,
yeah.
And also, I just have to point out. So, Art Scroll said David's intended wife.
Yeah, it's not, our school's trying to, our school certainly is cleaning up the language in the story here. That's our school. Yeah, even if it's true that they hadn't really been married, it certainly is morally reprehensible. I think that much is certain.
Yes.
I mean, in terms of the legality of it, you can quibble.
He was in her bed.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I don't know if that says, I don't know if, yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, our school is not relying on their own thing. There are some Mepharshim who say similarly, but it's certainly they're trying to whitewash a little bit part of the stories.
Okay.
Yeah. But take a look again at chapter 18. Turn back there and see David's reaction when he's told about marrying the wife, or marrying a wife. What does he say? Turn back to page 692.
692.
These are the thinnest pages.
Yeah, these are very thin pages, yeah. 692. So David is told, you know, a few times about that he couldn't marry the king's daughter. And David's response is almost consistent. What does David say? Verse 18, he's told about the first daughter. And he says, you know, Mi anochi umi chayai mishpachat David b'Yisrael ki yeh chatan lemelech. Who am I that I will be the king's son-in-law? And is there any mention of the woman?
No.
No. And the next, afterwards, that first daughter gets married. Mm-hmm. The second daughter, we're told, loves David. No reaction on his part. And who does he talk about in terms of getting married? He talks about, look at verse 23. By Dabru of David, Shaul be David, Dabru Ma'ila, by Yomer David, David's response about getting married. Hanikalev enichem hitchatein ba'melech. Can I really marry the king into the king's family? Va'anochi ish rash v'nikle, I am too poor. The king ends up having a counterproposal. Why don't you get me, you know, 100 foreskins? And what does David do? David fills the request. And verse 27, we're told, Vayelechu vanasha vayach v'plishtim. He ends up killing 200 men. Vaymalum lamelech lihitchatein. Who is he getting married with? He does indeed this, lihitchatein, to marry. And who is he marrying? He's marrying Michal. But what's the word here? Lihitchatein means to get married to, and what's the word you'd expect? You expect Michal. Instead, what is it? Lihitchatein b'melech, to marry the king.
Yeah.
Right? Everything from David's perspective, who is he marrying? He's marrying the king. He's marrying into the king's family. He's not focusing on the specific person he's marrying, because for him, she's a status. Right? He doesn't fall in love with. He would have been just as happy with the other wife, the other sister.
Yeah.
Right? It's the same thing for him.
Mm-hmm.
For him, what matters is becoming the son, the king's son-in-law. And to be clear, I think it's like, you know, anytime
But Shmuel,
if you can marry, you know, the president's daughter or some, or you know, the president's son, that's obviously like a really great, you know, obviously.
Remember Shmuel.
Obviously, marrying into such a powerful family is going to play a large role, you know, in how you view it. You're going to view that as yichus, it's important, mm-hmm. but it shouldn't be the only thing. The fact that you only care about the marriage because of the yichus you're going to receive, mm-hmm. because it's going to give you some type of government position, that's, you know, it says something quite serious.
No, I don't agree with you. Because in those days, they had polygamy. So they weren't stuck with one.
Yeah, so maybe. So maybe.
So they could have married her, and he could have married who, you know.
You're certainly right. Certainly from then, like, I think you're right that, you know, we have kind of this, a like, romantic view of love and marriage that they didn't really have. That's certainly true. They had more of an economical and utilitarian purpose to marriage.
Right.
But I think, maybe I'll re-clarify. I think it's fascinating that in a marriage where the only time in Tanakh a woman explicitly, over and over again, loves a man, we don't have any reciprocity. If anything, it's entirely utilitarian on David's part. It's entirely for the goal of becoming the king's son-in-law. Right? There is no reciprocity. He does not share in that emotional response.
And so what therefore, about when one could say that because he didn't have that emotional response, it's not surprising that when he ran away, he didn't care about being in contact with her, even though she
hasn't been in contact with her. Yeah,
I mean, shows he's not very.
Yeah, we don't know if he's in contact with her, but it's also true that she doesn't try to get in contact with him.
Right, exactly.
Because, and you know, I'm not sure I blame her. When you have a one-sided relationship, you do everything for, you know, the man you love, and you don't get anything back, is it such a surprise that with time, with distance, he's not around? Maybe when your father comes to you and says, I want you to marry someone else, maybe you're like, okay, daddy. You know, maybe you're not fighting so much.
Well, also,
the woman who's willing to lie to her father, maybe she's less willing to fight because she does not feel, you know, I don't feel like he loves me anyways.
Well, also the fact that he never tried to get in touch with her kind of shows that he was interested in being the king.
Yeah,
so, now the king doesn't like him anymore, so...
Yeah, I don't know if he was trying to be in touch. I don't know if he was trying or not trying to be in touch with her, but it's certainly true that throughout their marriage, it's almost consistently from very much utilitarian for him. It's very much, I want her because she's going to give me access, you know, to the king.
She's a means to an end.
Absolutely, yeah.
I was going to say that...
Which is typical.
Ahasuerus and Vashti... It said it in the Megillah that he, in a sense, married her for his title because he didn't marry her for anything else because they said that he was working with horses and everything.
This is a Midrash, The Midrash suggests, But certainly there are plenty of marriages back at the time. I don't mean to suggest the fact that David is marrying someone not for love, that I don't think that's itself a critique.
I don't
think I'm critiquing David for that because that's very common.
Very common.
But I think
Shlomo did the same.
Yeah, no, they all do it.
The kings.
Yeah, they all do it. I don't think that's necessarily the problem. I think more the issue is that you have a clear imbalance in the marriage.
Right.
I think anytime you have a marriage where if two people go into marriage knowing this is purely economical, right? I need your resources, you need my resources. I don't think, you know, maybe it's not the best marriage. We prefer nowadays seeing, you know, love and, you know, mutual respect in a marriage. But I think it's okay. Like, I think that's could be a very healthy marriage as long as you're both on equal footing with equal plans. You know, you have the same intentions. But when one of you, you know, is full of love, full of devotion, full of sacrifice, and the other one isn't.
In those days, the women's roles were so different. You know, there was no equality. You know, the women were chattel, really. They were owned.
But it's interesting then that she doesn't follow him then. I think the fact that she doesn't follow him.
Did she have resources? We don't know.
But she could have followed him.
She was the king's daughter.
The fact that
but her father, she tricked her father.
Yeah, at the moment, I agree. At that moment.
She had, you know, maybe he didn't give her a penny. You tricked me. I'm not, you know, you're.
But David ends up. There are other points in the story where David seems to be around in the palace area again. It does seem to happen. I mean, the story,
I don't know anything.
The order of the story is a little bit confusing, but it definitely seems David is around. And she does never follow him. As opposed to, who does follow her husband when he runs away?
And Rachel.
Rachel and Leah run away. They do run away with Yaakov.
Right.
There is a very different story there. And I'm going to come back to that, because I think part of this is we do have this unraveling of this marriage. This marriage does really seem to come apart. One other defense of Michal...
Do we know how long they were together? We
don't idea, no. According to Archibald, they never even were together. Right? That's what we pointed out. I don't know if that's necessarily true, but it's also worth pointing out, this is, I think someone else might have pointed it out, but right before we're told that Michal gets married to someone else, who got married to someone else?
David.
David marries two other women. Mm-hmm. Now, yes, it's true. Polygamy happened and other people got married to multiple people. It did happen. Mm-hmm. But you can certainly feel, you know, a little bit of her pain. My husband doesn't really love me, doesn't really care for me, and he married two other women, you know? He clearly.
How many wives did Shaul have?
Not clear.
Uh-huh.
For according to David, he only had one.
Mm-hmm.
But he might have had Pilakshim, it's not entirely clear.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, you know, I certainly think it doesn't help, you know, in a marriage to have more than one partner in this type of setting. You know, I think it certainly is distancing.
Mm-hmm.
I see what time is running out, so I kind of want to skip to the end of the story. Because the story continues. At some point, David ends up, after Shaul dies, David ends up trying to become king. But... there is a power struggle because one of David's children also becomes king. And so there's kind of for 5 years this power struggle. Who will end up being king? David is currently the king only of the Judeans in Hebron. And Ishbosheth is still the king from Binyamin. So there's kind of this power struggle. At some point, it starts getting resolved. And the general for the opposite side, Abner ben Ner, comes to David and says, I want to make a treaty with you. I want to switch sides. Join your side. And David has the following response. Turn to page... Da, da, da. Turn to page... 730. David at that moment has the following response. Let me look at the time. Okay. We might go like 5 minutes over, but not more than that. David has the following response. He says, I want to make this deal with you. I want to, indeed, you come over to my side. The guy, the opposing general, says, I'm going to bring, you know, the entire Israel. I'm going to unite them. You're going to be king over everyone. And what does David say to him? He says, verse 13, Vayomer tov, ani echrot itecha berit. Good, indeed, I will make a covenant with you. Ach davar echad, anochi shuel mitcha lemor. I'm asking one thing of you. Lo tire et panai, ki im lifnei viachat michal bat Shaul, bevoacha lirot et panai. Before you come to see me again, I want you to bring Michal bat Shaul. I want you to bring her back to me. Who is Michal bat Shaul in this case? Is it his wife? Well, it doesn't say Ishti. Mm-hmm. There's no language of endearment. And they're like, I'm missing her. I want my wife. Mm-hmm. No language of endearment. I want the Michal, the daughter of the previous king, to come back to me. Mm-hmm. Right? It almost sounds, again, utilitarian. Right? We have this power struggle. Which king? Who's the real king? So the other king is the son of, you know, Shaul. How am I going to claim my stake? I'm going to make sure that I have the queen, the daughter of the previous king, return to me to really affirm, you know, my stake as the future king. Very much utilitarian. And he says, sends a second letter. We're told, Vayishlach David malachim el Ishbosheth ben Shaul lemor. David sends messengers to Ishbosheth, to the actual king. Tanat ishti et Michal, bring me back my wife, asher irasti li b'me'a orlot plishtim, that I married with 100 plishtim, right? And I paid for.
Not
time,
but who's counting?
Yeah, I paid for. Right here too, he's asking another request, and it's a little bit more romantic because he asks for her. He talks about his wife, and he asks about how he paid for her. But like, I use the language "paid for" deliberately because it's still a little bit utilitarian. It doesn't sound like I love her, I miss her. You know, she belongs with me because, you know, I can't live without her. All the type of things that you'd expect, you know, a brother-in-law to kind of tell his brother-in-law, like, hey, bring back my wife because I really miss her. Well, David is very much, you know, I paid for her, bring him back to me. And if the story isn't clear yet, take a look at the way that she leaves. Vayishlach Ishbosheth vayikachem me'im ish. Indeed, Ishbosheth accedes to David's request, and he takes her from her man. Me'im paltiel ben la'ish. He takes her. Vayelech ita isha. So you can imagine, like, some messenger comes, and, like, the king's guard comes, and grabs her from the house, and escorts her over. And what happens? Her husband, paltiel ben la'ish, decides to walk with her. He doesn't have to, but he comes with her all the way Haloch uvacho achareha ad bachurim. And he comes and wails and cries the entire journey back. He is crying about the fact that he is losing his wife. Because for him, what does his wife mean? Not just property, not just connection to the king, but
he loves
his spouse, presumably. He loves her.
It says here,
yeah,
he never cohabited with her.
Yeah, that's the it's based on a midrash. Whether it's true or not that he ever ended up sleeping with her, it's like a separate question about, you know, it's a little bit of a separate consideration. But
so
I think
he wasn't technically her husband, was he?
Yeah, but I think technically, whether technically they were married or not married, the art school as a whole wants to try to really make sure they never were married, so nothing was wrong was done here. But I think certainly morally, we see there's clearly something happening, right? There is, first off, Michal was taken, perhaps, you know, not a great thing to do from David when David was married to her. But now there is this clear bond. And what does David want Michal back for?
She says property.
She wants him for a utilitarian purpose. Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. It's a pretty cruel act. Mm-hmm. Right? Michal maybe is finally, first time in life, she's finally happy. She found a man who loves her. Right? A man who really wants her. And David says, now somebody else wants you, come back to me. Now I want you. You know, I want what you have. Right? The shiny object that the kid next door has, I want that. Right? It wasn't interesting to me before, but now that you have it, I want it. Right? That's effectively David's response. I want, you know, it's almost cruel what happens here. What's Michal's reaction to all of this? We don't know. Michal doesn't say. But, you know, if I had to imagine, maybe she's very upset. Maybe she wants to stay with Palti. Maybe she's excited. Maybe she is like, you know, a mixed emotion, because maybe part of her is like, oh, finally, my husband wants me back. He wants to come start back to life again, right? Maybe he wants it back. And what happens? We have one more story with Michal and David. And in this story, we kind of come full circle, and we see Michal and David, what is their relationship like at this moment? And this is chapter 6. In chapter 6, turn to page 738.
Interesting.
738. The story here, David is bringing the Aron, the Ark of the Covenant, bringing it to Jerusalem. And as part of the celebrations, we're told that David is dancing wildly, right? He's jubilant, he's excited, he is, you know, simcha dancing, very, you know, he's doing all these DJ moves. He's doing all sorts of things, you know, to show off that his love for God and his love for God's covenant. And what happens, we're told as follows, verse 16. Vehaya, page 738. Vehaya Aron Hashem Ba'ir David. And it was as the ark approached the city of David, which is in Jerusalem. Umichal bat Shaul nishkifa be'ara chalon. And Michal, the daughter of Shaul, not the husband of David, look at the way it's expressed. Michal, the daughter of Shaul, she's looking out of the window. Vatera et haMelech David mifazez umecharker lifnei Hashem, vatives lo biliba. She sees David dancing wildly in front of God, and she is angry. She has contempt for him. Vayaviu, I'm skipping a few verses. At some point, verse 20. Vayashov David levarech et beito. So afterwards, David comes back home. Vateitze Michal bat Shaul likrat David. And Michal comes out to meet him. Vatomer, ma nichbad hayom melech Yisrael, asher nigla hayom leinei amhot avadav, ki galot niglot achad harikim. She condemns him. She says, you know, how, you know, almost like in this haughty, you know, laughing, scornful voice, you know, oh, look how great the king is that he, you know, acted with such impunity in front of, on such, you know, so disrespectful in front of all the women in Israel, right? You acted like you almost were naked in front of them. How you revealed yourself in front of the, you know, the daughters of Israel. It's very, you know, hurtful comment that she's making to him.
Well, the impression I had gotten, I don't know where I got it from, was that they didn't wear underwear in those days, and his dancing around, in fact, did expose himself.
It could be, that's true. Certainly, I think the major context is just, he's acting, you know, not royally. He's acting, you know, kind of, nothing like, but that might even, you might be literally right, he is in some ways revealing himself. And David's response is, "Vayomer David al Michal ifnei Hashem, asher b'charbi me'avicha, me'avich mekol beito letzavot oti nagid al am Hashem al Yisrael, v'sichakti lifnei Hashem. I am dancing in front of the God that chose me instead of your father, chose me instead of you to be king, I am dancing in front of him. V'nakloti od mizot v'ayiti shafal beinai, and I will even lower myself even more. Imaot asher amart imam echabeda, I will lower myself even more in front of all the women if I can praise God. That is the last words that we hear between David and Michal. Is this a happy marriage?
No.
This end of this marriage has really devolved. Mm-hmm. Whether Michal's, certainly the context here, the explicit text, is some type of debate about how you respect God and how you conduct yourself in public, right? That's certainly the main debate here, you know, on the surface, right? Michal comes from her father's house and they conduct themselves, you know, maybe, you know, a certain stately way. And David thinks, no, that's not the way I'm going to act. Instead, I'm going to praise God. But beneath the surface here, what's really happening in this marriage, right? You can understand the emotions. I think this is one of the more emotionally powerful stories. Michal feels hurt. She feels that her husband, you know, never really loved her again. Not only that, but what is David doing? All of this energy he's putting, who is he loving in this story?
God.
He loves God. He puts all this energy for God. And notice what she says. She says, not only have you revealed yourself before God, but you revealed yourself in front of the other woman, right? Anytime someone in a marriage says something about other women or other men, what they're really saying is, I don't feel like you love me. I feel like you're focusing on others. Well, I don't think David is actually, you know, flirting with other women, but that's certainly the way she's almost perceiving it, because that's the way she feels hurt. She does not feel that he loves her. And so her language is this biting, you know, critique of David, and David's response, almost in kind, is, okay, if you're going to insult me that way, so I'm going to also respond emotionally and not just debate about the, you know, the legalities of what exactly how we should conduct ourselves, but I'm going to almost insult you. I'm going to compare and contrast. I'm going to say, you and your father, you know, you do one thing and I do something else. I do something better, right? We're not in the same camp. We're different people, right? We aren't in the same marriage, so to speak. You know, you're over here and I'm way over here. We're different places. So I think clearly the subtext here is there's really acerbic, you know, dangerous last words we said between the two of them. And the last thing we hear about Michal, the very last verse of this chapter, "Umichal bat Shaul lo hayala yeled ad yom mota." Perhaps the saddest verse, Michal does not have a child. Now, I'll remind you, having a child in Tanakh is probably the greatest thing for a woman to accomplish, like the greatest accomplishment within that world. And for women not to have a child, that is a statement not only about her lack of accomplishment, but also the lack of a future, right? Children are the future. You have a legacy. And Michal has no legacy. She has no future. David is going to have a long dynasty, many children, and Michal is not going to be part of it. She's going to be stuck behind. And
is there anybody else in Tanakh who was similar to her?
Not exactly in this way, mm-hmm. but I'll bring us back to where we were. Mm-hmm. We started off this whole thing. Let me take one other thing before I get there. Before I get there, it's worth pointing out, because I don't want to forget it. In this story, where is Michal seeing David from? From a window. Did we see a window with Michal originally in some other story?
She led him down.
So we have the same symbol, same motif of a window. Mm-hmm. Beforehand, the window showed closeness. It showed that, you know, though we're going to be apart, the two of us are together. I'm going wherever I can to save you. And here, the window shows distance. They couldn't be further apart from each other. Right? The same motif is being used, mm-hmm. right? They show their distance. Mm-hmm. But I want to come back. I want to end with this. I want to come back and talk about what I first began with, was the story of Michal and David, we said, reminds us very strongly of who? The story of Yaakov and Rachel. And the story of Yaakov and Rachel, we spoke about the parallels in terms of the marriage. We spoke about the parallels in terms of running away. But Yaakov and Rachel, there's also one other parallel. Because Yaakov and Rachel, do they have a perfect marriage? No, they have some fight. I mean, not to say it's unperfect, but they have a fight. What is their fight about? Rachel comes to Yaakov and says, I don't have any children, right? Where are my children? And if I'm not going to have a child, then I might as well die. I want to die. There's no reason for me to live. And what is Yaakov's response? Yaakov has this almost cruel, mean response. He says, you know, I'm not God, speak to God. Now, every couple, you know, fights. And does Yaakov and Rachel, do they end up reconciling?
I guess, because they had two children.
Seemingly, yes. Seemingly, it's not the end of the story. They end up meeting together. You know, they end up, Yaakov ends up protecting Rachel later on in terms of when they meet Esav. Rachel is clearly the favorite one. Her and her child are going to be protected most. Right? Yaakov and Rachel seem to get, you know, I don't know if they're ever a perfect marriage, but they seem to certainly get on better terms. And while Yaakov's response in that story is not great, or not good at all, I think what it characterizes us for us is that while they have a fight, every couple can have a fight, but then you know how to reconcile. Or maybe, I don't want to say fully reconciled, but they certainly, you know, moved on. And one of the best ways I can tell you that they moved on, one of the clear indications of how fights, you know, go on, how long is the fight? This isn't always true. You can have a long fight and still reconcile. But Yaakov's response, the whole thing, is two very short verses. It lasts maybe 15 words, the whole thing, the whole fight. Right? Imagine your fights were only 15 words. It'd be quite a short fight. And here, David and Michal, they're talking for verses. It's like almost five verses of fighting, right? Which I think really highlights the fact that this is not... you know, there's a lot more here. It's not just a short fight. And I think it's the way I kind of think of it is, you know, oftentimes, you know, you might fight once about a certain something, but more often than not, sometimes you might have the same fights over and over again. And those fights often tend to be a lot worse, even if the content's not more serious, but they tend to be, you know, because you end up replaying the same fights, never resolving it, those type of fights are a lot worse. And I think what we see here then, through the contrast really between Rachel and Yaakov versus David and Michal, is that yes, they had fights. Yes, not every marriage is perfect, but they end up learning to reconcile. And Yaakov loved Rachel to the end of his life, and they somehow found a way to reconcile. And Rachel ends up having children. As opposed to here, Michal does not have a future. Michal does not have the same marriage. And I think there's something to be said about their marriage from the very beginning, beginning on an unequal footing, and it clearly stays that way throughout. I want to end with one very last point. You'll allow me. I know it's already 1:06. Okay. One last point, which is that while all of this is true, certainly true that Michal's relationship with David is, I think, worse in many ways, especially by the end, than Yaakov and Rachel. The Midrash, that I think we quoted like a few weeks ago, there's a Midrash that compares three women who die in childbirth. Who are the three women who die in childbirth? Rachel, Eshet Pinchas, she's the woman we talked about a few weeks ago. She's the wife of Pinchas who died in the battle in the beginning of Shmuel. Pinchas is Eli's child, one of the Kohen, the Kohen Gadol's child, who dies in battle when the Aron is captured, and his wife hears the news that he died in battle, and she dies in childbirth. And she names her child Ikavod, because there is no respect, no honor in Israel. Right? We talked about this story, you know, a few weeks ago. And the third person that the Midrash talks about who died in childbirth is who? Michal. Now, in our story, it's not clear Michal dies in childbirth. There's no mention of that. If anything, she says she doesn't have children. But I think the Midrash intentionally links these three women because the point is that all three of these women die in a rather tragic way. Not just because, you know, dying in childbirth is certainly tragic, you know, in its own right. Or, you know, it's certainly an example of, you know, one of the many dangers that existed for women back then and, you know, could have happened. But I think what all three of these stories suggest is that the same commonality is these women are not part of the future. They end up, because of their unfortunate circumstances, being stuck in the past. Michal certainly does not move on. David has a very, you know, famous reign. Everyone knows King David. Everyone knows his descendants. No one knows about Michal. I mean, we read the story, but Michal is not a famous story. She's not a historical figure, mm-hmm. right? No one writes her story. Mm-hmm. And Eshet Pinchas, when her husband dies in battle, when the Aron is captured, she says, there's no point for me to live anymore. There's no honor in Israel. I might as well die because there is no future for us. And Rachel ends up having children, but she dies in childbirth. And her children, what ended up happening with them? Well, think about her husband. Her husband lives for another, I don't know, at least almost 60 years or 70 years. Her husband lives a very long time after she dies. And who is her husband buried with? Not with her, but with the other wife, with her sister. The story of Rachel, it's a tragedy. Mm-hmm. It's a sad story. There's no other way. Yes, their marriage might have been better, but Yaakov and Rachel do not end up together. Right? Rachel is left, you know, buried in an honorable place, but by the side of the road. Mm-hmm. Who's buried on the side of the road? It's like the carcasses of animals that, you know, are left on the side of the road. That's who gets buried on the side of the road. It's a respectful burial. But it's very sad. And I think the story of all three of these women is a story of unfortunate sadness that these women were not indeed part of the future. And Rachel is certainly a woman who the story continues, and she's able to be, you know, resurrected in some ways through, the role that she plays in the Galut later on, and the role that, you know, Kever Rachel plays, the tomb of Rachel plays certainly a very strong role in her historical narrative. She comes again. She has a future, but it's not the future with her husband. Not the future of the husband she loved. And Michal, you know, they're both tragic stories. And, you know, I know it's a little bit of a downer to end on, but I think it's just the most realistic way of saying it. These stories are not happy stories. Unfortunately, you know, they don't end positively. And it's, something to think about, the way that, you know, the marriage stories in both these stories take place, and the way that, unfortunately, despite the fact that Yaakov and Rachel might have had a better marriage, not unfortunately, they weren't able to finish their journey together.
Yeah, I was going to say that even so, Rachel is not very near Yaakov, but her name is mentioned more because everybody goes to her grave.
Yeah, absolutely. So she does have a future. She's not like Michal. She ends up having a future, and if anything, she becomes the mother of Israel. She becomes like Mama Rachel. Yeah, that's like, you know, she becomes the mother, so she's historically resurrected in some ways, like her legacy prevails. It's not as sad, but
she has
a legacy, but it's not the same one as maybe she dreamt of, you know, living another 70 years with her husband. The ending is unfortunately sad, better than maybe with Michal, who really, their marriage really collapses. But I think unfortunately these are two stories of real sadness. I don't think these are happy stories.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Putting aside the midrash about how Michal died, I don't think it cuts against your points in any way, but I have always thought that Michal didn't have children for one of two reasons. One either was because she castigated David for glorifying God. God would get upset with that and not make her not have children. Or, after we've talked about how bad their marriage was, perhaps he didn't sleep with her again.
I think that's the main... Yeah, I think it's exactly
it. To me, that makes more sense than she died in childbirth. I think the part that even strengthens your position in a way, because you're saying they had this really bad, distant marriage.
Yeah,
the wives, and so he didn't give her children.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he
didn't have anything to do with her.
I think the way the story presented here is that he ignored her for the rest of, you know, his life. Kind of the way that Achashverosh marries, you know, tries out all these different women, and what are we told? That if... that after he tries them out for one night, they're sent off to the house of the Pilagshim unless he calls them back. And presumably he never calls them back. So, you know, these women are to die in the king's palace, you know, tied up and chained. And Michal probably died the same, unfortunately, you know, dies the same way. And it's this tragic, tragic story. I know it's a really sad way to end it. I wish I had a happier news. Sometimes life has sad stories.
I was just going to say, isn't that real life?
Like
sometimes you're the happy story, sometimes sad.
Sometimes we have some sad stories. Yeah, this is certainly, and I think it's a critique of David. I don't think this is a story that reflects well on him. I'm not saying the marriage is entirely his fault. You know, every marriage is a partnership, and it requires two to tango. But it certainly, he definitely played a role.
He was a womanizer.
Yeah. He definitely married a lot of women. Yeah.
Excuse me. I just want to wish you a Chag Sameach and a wonderful trip.
Thank you.
Chag Kosher
Sameach. Chag Kosher Sameach. Yes. We are done. Somebody wants to go. I apologize. Yeah.
I know somebody who's